I got this slide from Stephen Porges. Well, of course it isn't cold blood, you idiot. I'm a reptile. And so when we really become really upset, we become reptiles. We are not nice people. We're not considerate people. We just so how do you deal with that? How do you deal with this overwhelming fear and terror? Most of all, what we saw in New York is community and touch. And you guys are going to talk about touch, which is great, because touch is just completely forgotten off the map. And how can you be an all right person if you do not know what the safety and the comfort of touch feels like? And so many traumatized people are terrified of being touched. And so those systems need to be opened up to get that fundamental sense of comfort. And that's what this is a picture I took in New York, actually. How do you screw people up? This is a picture that was taken after Hurricane Katrina. These guys have just all lost their houses. And they're filled with stress hormones. People in Philadelphia, like people in New York, know about stress hormones. Your blizzards aren't as bad as ours. But part of what makes New England great is our blizzards and our snowstorms. And say every time it happens, you go, shit, I wish I'd moved to Florida. And then the stress hormones are pumping, and you go and you grab your shovel and you start shoveling and you use your stress hormones. And by the end of the day, you're closer friends to your neighbors. You cook a nice meal and you feel we are much better people than people in Southern California. You have it so easy. So stress hormones are good for you as long as you can use them. So here are these poor guys who are filled with stress hormones after their houses get destroyed. And why do they have stress hormones? They go to Home Depot to get 2x4s and hammers and nails to repair their houses. Because as long as you can do something, that's what the body creates stress hormones for. What do the people do? They say, we're going to give the contract to Halliburton, which is a company whose headquarters are in Dubai. I saw it. I went to the headquarters. So they don't have to pay tax in the U.S., but they're friends of the president, and they are going to repair your house, but there's nothing you can do, and you're going to live in some damn trailer in Salt Lake City or Houston while other people do a lousy job repairing your house. If you want to screw people up, that's how you do it. You make people completely helpless and make them unable to utilize the power that they have to repair themselves. And indeed, we have the data for that. Somebody did a survey in various American cities in 2003-2004 about the prevalence of mental illness. New Orleans happened to have a lot of mental illness before Hurricane Katrina, about 12% PTSD. 3 years after Hurricane Katrina, 35% PTSD, the highest ever measured in a Western cultural society because of this. If you make people feel helpless, they will develop PTSD. That's an issue of lack of community, lack of safety, lack of action. You screw people up. All these things have huge political dimensions that you can never get away from. So back to Noah. Noam is now 20-something years old. He's studying city planning in Amsterdam. I should have another picture. But back then he was 5 and a half, and I visit my friends a few days after 9/11, and he shows me this picture that he drew on September 12th at 9 o'clock in the morning, so exactly 24 hours after he gets exposed to all this stuff. And I think that's an amazing picture. So I say to Noam, can I have that picture? I'm writing this book, and I really would like to put it in that book. He says, no. And I say, but it will be in a book. Like, I said, no, but I'll sell it to you. And and I say, how much? He says, $100. I say, nobody ever paid $100 for a 5-year-old kid for a drawing. He says, that's what it is. So I give him $100. And he smiles. I think, I got this guy. He lives 2 blocks from the World Trade Center. He probably made hundreds more pictures like that and sold it to a tourist. I think he earned his entire college degree by having been able to bamboozle me into it. Now that's resilience, huh? And so trauma brings out creativity in people. I was just talking to my last patient I saw before coming to Philadelphia today, is that to my mind, all creative things get discovered out of trauma. Because if everything is safe and everybody loves you, you get lazy. But if life is desperate, you go to find new solutions to all problems because you have to. Newton was one of the most horrifically traumatized person who ever lived. He was a little crazy also, but he invented mathematics. So trauma also gives rise to amazing creativity, as it did in Little Noah. So why did it pay such an excessive amount of money for this picture? I'll show you. So he explains it to me. It's the World Trade Center, people jumping out, firefighters. There's a telephone booth that they're no longer working. Everybody tries to call home and doesn't work. And so what's that? And he says, that's, when the planes hit, there was this fireball. And the heat of the fireball came through the classroom window. And I thought we were going to burn up. They go, yeah, that's trauma. You remember trauma from sensations. Everybody who I have talked to who escaped from the World Trade Center that day is triggered by sounds, because they were running down the staircase and this gigantic building was coming apart, and they remember the sound. Rape victims are oftentimes triggered by smells, sounds, images. So it's not stories, it's all about images, pieces of the past that come into people's minds. That actually is what trauma is all about, something that that the mind falls apart and cannot put it together, and you keep sort of re-experiences sensations, images, feelings, body sensations, sounds, and they sort of lead this independent existence in your brain. And so the job of trauma treatment is to integrate it and to help all these pieces to come together, which is, I'll talk a little bit about tomorrow. And he still feels the same. And I say, so what's that? He says, that's a trampoline. And I go, what's a trampoline doing there? He says, so that when people have to jump, they'll be okay. And I go, wow. That's why I paid $100 for this picture. Wow. So 2 days before, you remember, you waited for President Bush to give his talk about what happened. And you know from experience, after Kennedy was killed and after the Challenger space disaster, is that the national response of the president will create history. And our president goes on TV, and his opening lines is, we will kill them dead or alive. I go, holy shit. He is a limbic man. He's like an animal who, I have been hurt, so I'm going to hurt somebody. And America followed him, 92% approval rate, to kill the shit out of some people who had nothing to do with 9/11. And I knew at this point that that world history was going in a very bad direction. And if President Bush and the American people had been able to imagine a trampoline, the world would be completely different. And so imagination is everything. Being able to imagine new realities is really what it's all about. And so, to a large degree, trauma treatment is also about helping people to imagine new realities. Because when you're traumatized, when somebody touches you in a particular way, you feel like, oh, I'm going to get raped, or somebody's going to hit me. And so the brain gets very, very concrete about this means that. And you get a very closed mind about new possibilities. So treatment is about opening up new imaginations. And that's why I love theater, among other things. But opening up imagination is everything. And as long as you can imagine something. So my clinic was just devastated recently. And I've lived on imagining how to build a new clinic, actually. And as long as I can think, imagine how we can do that, we'll be okay. But as long as your imagination stops, you say, there's nothing I can do, the trauma starts getting into your body. Yeah? So opening up imagination is central. So how are we doing in terms of, shall we sort of leave it at this? How long do you want to go? I can talk till about 2:30 a.m. Why don't we have some questions? I think it'd be interesting, yeah. Just speak up. So everybody else, you'll pass the mic. We'll pass the microphone around, okay?
Yeah. Is this on? Yes. I go to a discussion group with chaplains in Philadelphia from hospitals, and a VA chaplain talked about a ritual he developed for veterans to heal moral injury.
Uh-huh.
And it included a service, and it included washing of hands, and it included therapists and veterans. And I don't know how this fits in with what you're talking about, but I know it was very emotionally important to the people involved.
I think there's two elements there. There's a lot of programs here and there where people do very interesting things. So the two elements that are real is that people are able to say what happened. Because moral injury actually is the very first thing that I wrote about in my book also, is that after your best friends get killed, you are going to go on the rampage and do terrible things to people. Huh? I mean, at the UPenn law school thing, I talked about people committing atrocities, which is pretty much routine when you become a soldier. And some high Pentagon guy said, but that's a war crime. And I go, Jack, it is. And you keep sending these boys to the war, and they will commit war crimes, because that's what people do. That's why I became a conscientious objector, because don't give me a machine gun. If all holds apart, I will kill people and take pleasure in doing that, and I don't want to experience that pleasure. And then you feel ashamed about yourself. So you feel this deep shame, and if you can share your shame with people, and you have a community that supports you in that, you can really leave it behind to some degree. So that's part of the deal. How effective any of that is, it's helpful. Whether it does the trick, we don't know. Because the money is not about to study that in detail to what degree people move. We'll talk about it a little bit more. We're doing psychedelics right now to do the same thing, to get people in a state of deep self-compassion where they can see what happened to them also. But the Native American tradition is also that you share what you have done, you repent for the evil deeds you have committed, and you get cleansed from it. This makes a lot of sense. Now, the question over there, you gave it to me, but maybe you ought to ask it. Yeah. Yeah. I can read it also. In post-alcoholic America, has the use of pornography play survival of PTSD? I don't know. Only thing I'm glad is that as a teenager, I did not have access to the internet. I might never have stopped watching pornography if it had been available to me. And I don't know how kids do it. I think what's happening in terms of the internet and accessibility stuff, and Lorraine and I were talking about on the way in here, kids live in a completely different world than me grew up in. And I have no idea how they cope with all of it. It's pretty terrifying. Yeah, but it's hard to come by. Oh, for me. I have no opinion about it.
One thing about when we use the mic, it's also recorded on the
writing about traumatic experiences.
Writing, yeah.
Is supposed to have a therapeutic effect. Can you elaborate on that? Or
absolutely. Actually, writing is fantastic. What trauma is about is whatever you feel is too overwhelming. What is at the core of trauma is that you don't want to remember what happened to you because it's too much. So you try to block it out. The people around you say, get over it, and want to block it out because nobody wants to know how bad things really are. And so there's this inner and outer conspiracy to not know what you know. But your body remembers. So your stress hormone system will continue to react as if you're in danger. And so your body plays tricks on you while you have no words for it. And then if you can actually access your internal self and give words to what you do. Actually, for me, this is maybe the most interesting chapter in my book, to write my chapter about language. Because, I did the first Prozac research in PTSD. And nobody dismissed it by asking me, how does Prozac work? But then I did the first EMDR research, bringing your fingers in front of people's face. Everybody said, we don't know how it works. And I say, yeah, that's a good idea. Actually, we actually learned the recent piece of research where we sort of figured out how it works. It's very complicated. And I said, yeah, we don't know how EMDR works, but then we don't really know how Prozac works either. And then I said, how about talking? How does talking work? And I go through literature, and I cannot find a single article in the last 100 years that tries to figure out why talking might be helpful. So I get intrigued with that. What can talking do, and what can talking not do? And talking can do a lot. It cannot do everything. But the research I come across is the research of Jamie Pennebaker. And Pennebaker had a Psych 101 class. He divides it up into three pieces. And he says to that group, get a notebook and write about the fate of our athletic teams every day for 10 minutes. And this middle group here, get a notebook and write about the most terrible things that have happened to you. And he says to this group, get a notebook and write about the most terrible things that have happened to you and how it affects your life right now. And, of course, nothing happens to this group and nothing happens to this group. This is the group, the grades go up, their friendship patterns go up, their immune system improves. So finding words for your internal experience and becoming conscious about who you are and how the past is affecting you right now and finding words for it brings about liberation. And then I do my yoga study. And I think, wouldn't it be interesting to compare yoga, which doesn't involve any writing about your trauma whatsoever, talking about your trauma, with writing about your trauma like that, which is completely different. And the results that I look up in the literature aren't very good. So I call Pennebaker and I say, so what's up with that language and trauma? He says, those damn therapists, they don't read what I do. What I do is you're supposed to write for yourself. It's very much like many people in this room have probably done it after somebody has really hurt you, insulted you, and betrayed you. You write him a very angry letter. And you probably didn't send it to those people because you didn't want anybody to know what evil thoughts you had on your mind. But writing those things on a piece of paper gave a tremendous sense of clarity and truth to you. Huh? And he says, but when therapists get involved, they always say, tell me what you wrote. Tell other people what you wrote. He says, that's not the issue. You need to find language for yourself, for your internal experience. So as I'm writing that chapter, I think, I wonder what my friend Judy Herman wrote in her famous book, Trauma and Recovery, which most people of that generation read. It's a wonderful book. And I wonder what she wrote about writing. And she writes in 1992 exactly what I would have written in 1992. She says, if somebody brings in a piece of writing, don't have them be lazy and have them read to you what they wrote. Exactly what I would have written back in 1992 is the opposite of what I wrote 4 years ago. Because right now, if somebody brings a piece of writing and shares it with me, I treat it like a sacrament. I say, wow, you trust me with your innermost thoughts about stuff you can barely find words for. That must have been agonizing for you to write. Thank you very much for trusting me with those few words that you have found. And I wait till they're ready to talk about it.